Ladies and gentlemen, welcome wrestling fans worldwide to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of the largest and oldest wrestling family on the planet.
The Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The Stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the Stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the Stud is here.
Now, to the creator of the popular 605 Super Podcast and the president of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcasting Network, please welcome your co-host, the great Brian Last.
Hello again, friends. This is the great Brian Last once again here with Ron Fuller's Studcast. And I'm very happy to once again introduce to you your host, the Tennessee Stud himself, Ron Fuller.
Well, thank you very much, Brian. It's my pleasure, as always, to be here with you, man. It's a great day down here in the Smokies, and really enjoying it, and I'm just really looking forward to this. I think we got started in a good direction last week. Maybe off the top, Brian, if you don't mind, I want to thank all my listeners. I do this probably not often enough, but I really appreciate the great audience that I'm in the process of building. And at the same time, I also want to thank those patrons, those people that have gotten on board and taken those Super Stud casts and the rest of the story. I want to thank them for their support that helps us to continue to do these Stud casts. And I just am really, really pleased with the response. I'm humbled by it. I always have been since the very beginning, about how many listeners I have and how fervent they are about their enjoyment of the program and the product that we put out. And obviously, I thank you very much for being here and being a part of it. Your name speaks podcasting as well as any name probably out there. And really appreciate you being in the chair that you're in, too.
Well, Ron, it's my pleasure to be here. And like you said, the feedback has been pretty extraordinary the last few weeks. And we're going to pick up right from where we left off. You know, last time on the show, we talked about your first time regularly working a territory. Not your first match, but your first regular territory. And of course, we're speaking of Atlanta, Georgia, 1970. But Georgia and Atlanta, Georgia are two different things, and Georgia was more than Atlanta. We're going to talk about that today, but also we're going to go back to a topic you addressed last week on the show, which is what the lifestyle is like, what it's like for a young wrestler just starting out. And I believe that's where we're going to start out again.
Yeah, I think that's a great place for us to start. We had great reaction. I really go and look at comments. I want to see how fans are enjoying the program, what they like, what they don't. Got a great reaction about our program last week, and because we really got into discussing what it's like to be a young wrestler. And in that vein, let's just go further into that subject. I mean, we talked about the injuries and the knees and the mat burns and all the things that a young wrestler encounters. And there's more to it than that. Let's look at it from a different side and a different aspect. It's a real adjustment in any person's life. Being a wrestler is a pretty unique sport. It's a pretty unique profession. What you do when you're a wrestler is you travel at night. You're a night person. It's kind of like a night job. And sometimes that can be from in the afternoon when time you leave and start. Back in the old days, you drove to most matches. So you left in the afternoons. If you're wrestling someplace like Savannah as an example, and you live in Atlanta, you're about a 4-hour trip away from being there and being ready to start doing any wrestling at all. So your days sometimes start in the mid-afternoons, and they don't end until 2, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning. That takes a big adjustment to get used to. Most people go to bed at 10, 11 o'clock, and they're up at 6, 7 maybe, and they're off to their work, and they go home in a normal time, have dinner at a normal time. When you become a professional wrestler, your life totally changes. You don't eat at the same time that you used to anymore. You don't go to bed at the same time. You don't get up at the same time. It's really a tremendous adjustment. And most guys are young when they start. So, you know, it's a real adjustment. And I found it pretty difficult in the beginning, especially adjusting to the trips. Everybody traveled by cars back in those days, in the 1970s. You didn't fly very often unless you were in a bigger territory. When I get to Florida a few months down the road, I'm going to start to experience flying into the Caribbean. But in Georgia, you drove. And you wrestled in a lot of different cities. And it wasn't just my brother and I. We were both young. We were young guys in the crew. There were a couple of other young guys in that crew in 1970. Two Oates boys, Jerry and Ted Oates. Two great little wrestlers. They're from down around the Columbus, Georgia area. I believe they're out of the Columbus area. And those guys were trying to get themselves a start. Same time Rob and I were trying to get a start. There were good tag teams. We talked some last week about the tag teams that were there. Obviously, you had Chadi and Fuji, the Japanese guys, and you had the Assassins. So, you know, there's a couple of tag teams there. You got my father, Buddy Fuller, and Ray Gunkel. You have Rob and I as a tag team. And you have the Oates brothers as young boys who are trying to get a start and trying to get somewhere, too. So, we're all out there experiencing this at the same time. And you sit and talk with each other when you're a wrestler. You got a lot of time in the dressing room and you discuss. When you're a young guy and we're all going through the same thing, you want to talk about, well, hey, how are you handling the elbows? I noticed you got a bursitis problem there with your elbow. Different things come up all the time. You create great relationships in professional wrestling because you spend a lot of time with those guys. Lots of guys back in the early days in the 70s would drive four guys in a car. They would share the rides every night. So let's say Monday night you're in Augusta, you'd get into a car sometimes with Bob Armstrong as an example, and there might be Bill Dromo and Bob Armstrong and me and Rob. And we would drive to Augusta. If we drove home back to Atlanta, the next day it'd be somebody else's turn to drive. And you would share those cars and you spent hours and hours every day with the same guys. You got to know them very well. And if those guys were great guys, and most of them in wrestling were, they were willing to help you and they were willing to discuss things with you, to teach you. Even while you're driving to and from towns, you could learn about what you did in your match that night that you could have done better. You just always got this great critique from different people, and that helped everybody, all this young talent that was coming into the entire. Now, we're not just talking Georgia. There's a tremendous amount of young talent that is exploding all across America. You've got the Von Erich boys who are turning into an age of starting to wrestle. And you have these family members. You've got the Greg Gagne's up in Minnesota. You've got so many different families that are having kids. You've got the rest of the Welches. Lester's two sons are starting. You got the Fields boys down there along the Gulf Coast, Bobby Lee and Don's sons. They're getting started. So there's an influx of great young talent. You got Jerry Lawler in the Memphis area. You've got great talent, young guys that are going to become future stars, and they're getting this great mentoring from those men, those wrestlers that came before them that have learned their way around, and they have the ability to not just talk to you about it, but sometimes in the dressing room, show you what you need to be doing, show you moves in the dressing room itself. So it's a great place to be. It's a great sport to be in. We're all excited about it. I'm excited about it. My brother's excited about it. Anybody that's wanting to be a young wrestler and he has the opportunity to become part of a great crew like that summer 1970 Georgia crew, they are just thrilled to be a part of it. And that's, it's a great life, but it's a life that requires a lot of adjustment in many, many ways. Gym time. You don't want to forget your gym. The gym got you there. It's not the most important part of the business. Now, as time goes by, when you're going into the late 80s and into the 90s, those gym bodies are going to get bigger and those guys are going to get more muscular. But they're going to give up some of that wrestling talent and some of that wrestling ability to build that bigger body. And that's going to reshape wrestling as we get 10 years, 15, 20 years, 30 years down the road. The sport is going to change from being a wrestling-based sport to a bodybuilder sport in a lot of ways. And I don't think that was a good thing to have happen, but it was probably a natural progression.
Two questions come at everything you just said, Ron. One is on the topic of gyms. I know that you work out, and if you go into a gym now, it's usually a pretty nice experience, a rather clean experience. What were gyms like in 1970 when you broke into the business?
A little rat holes. they weren't beautiful. And the equipment was old and dilapidated, and there was very limited universals type equipment. So everything was basically dumbbells and barbells, and then you throw those 45-pound weights on there, and you just go do your thing. But it's, you know, nowadays it's big business. It's huge business nowadays. You go into these monster gyms. I have had memberships in some of the bigger gyms, and I love them because you got everything there. And you not only have the ability to go in there and just work out, but you can go in there and you can play racquetball, and you can go in there and you can swim. You can go in there and you can sauna. It's a full access of all different types of entertainment and all different types of things that you can enjoy in gyms today. That back in the old days, it was pretty well, clear cut. You had just a few things, a couple benches here, not much of equipment, and you had to adjust to the gym. You had to get the best you could out of your gym. And nowadays, the gyms they're prepared for anybody and whatever you want to do.
And then in terms of the wrestler lifestyle, the schedule, the sleep schedule, as it were, how big of an adjustment was it for you? Because you weren't just a student in Miami, you were a student athlete. And obviously an athlete in college usually has a very different sleep schedule than a professional wrestler. What was the adjustment like for you specifically from student athlete into professional wrestling? And then if we could fast forward a little bit ahead, what was that adjustment like for you when you went from being just a wrestler to being a wrestler and a business owner and a promoter?
Oh, it's like I was saying, it's a very difficult adjustment. Your body has to transition from getting up early to you quit getting up early. If you're going to make a trip to Savannah, Georgia, as an example, out of Atlanta, you're not going to get home to 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock in the morning. You won't get in bed till 4 o'clock. You're not going to get up at 8. It's not likely you're going to jump out of bed at 8. Now, my dad used to do that back in the 50s and 60s. He would make these horrible trips and be late getting home and get up and be working on the farm 4 hours later. But I didn't have a farm. I didn't want a farm. I was just trying to make wrestling my life and wrestling my career. And I wanted to get as much sleep as I could. I had to learn to make those adjustments. It takes time for that to happen for you. You'll get to where, though, within probably a year's time, I was comfortable with being up at 4 a.m. I was also comfortable at not getting up until 11 o'clock in the morning. That didn't bother me a bit. I worked my gym in the early afternoon, and then I went and got in the car, and I started the trip to wherever we were going. And since we got into that vein, let's talk a little bit about Georgia as an example and the trips that were in Georgia. Every territory had different type of trips, different distances. Georgia was probably, I'm going to say, average. As time went by and I went into more territories, I found that if you're in Texas, you're going to be on the road a lot. It's a big state. If you're in a small area, my southeastern area as an example in 1975 when I got that set up. Your longest trip was 120 miles. So guys were home by midnight most nights. And that was one of the reasons they loved that territory. They wanted to work there because they could be home early and they could live pretty much a normal life. But if you were in Georgia back in those days, Georgia was a unique territory. It did not have just one ownership. It had two different entities in the one territory. Now, that's unusual. I don't think I ever remember any place other than Georgia that had that situation in which they had an Atlanta office that's owned by my father, Buddy Fuller, and Ray Gunkel as partners. Paul Jones owns a little piece of it, and he's like a figurehead there. And then the southern part of the state from Macon, Georgia, south, was run by Fred Ward. Fred Ward was an old-time wrestler himself, had been in the ring, had paid his dues, somehow worked himself into a position to where he started to run towns. He ran his big towns, were Macon, Georgia, and Columbus, Georgia. He ran Albany and Americus and several spot shows that were south of Macon, and that was considered to be his area. Now, he had his own TVs. He had to, because he had two cities that were far enough apart they couldn't get the same television. So he had a television in Macon, and he had a television in Columbus. Columbus he used to do on Saturdays at 3 o'clock. So he had, at 3 p.m., he did a live TV, had his own little studio. His son-in-laws, one was a referee, the other one ran his production, his television production. And those guys were crazy guys in a way, too. I don't know if you've ever heard of a guy that was his son-in-law there was Ralph and one was Leon Ogle. Now, there's a Leon. I don't know if you've heard this story, and you probably have. Leon Ogle was his son-in-law. He basically handled the production of Fred's program in Columbus, Georgia. And he went home one time and found three robbers in his house when he got there. And he shot one. He beat one almost to death with a baseball bat. And the third one, the police, I think, shot. So he walked into a bad situation and somehow was able to turn it into the end for the other guy, the bad guy, rather than the good guy. And that became a big story. And I think that was in the Columbus area where that happened. It became a big story around the country. They had another son-in-law, and the guys used to call him Rooster. His name was Ralph. And Ralph hated to be called Rooster. And I think the wrestlers are pretty difficult sometimes. If they want to get on you and they want to rib you or they want to give you a hard time, they can be very good at it. And so they drove Ralph crazy with his little nickname Rooster. And the fact that he didn't like to be called Rooster made everybody call him Rooster. And it made a difficult thing for him. But he had the Macon TV. They ran their Macon TV on an odd day. They would do it in the middle of the week. They would do that TV in the afternoons on a Tuesday. And they would tape it. So they were running a tape TV out of Macon. They were running a live TV on Saturdays out of Columbus. And on Saturday morning, about 8 o'clock in the morning, Channel 11 in Atlanta was cranking up and taping their program that they're going to show later in the day. So you got three televisions that you have to deal with in that territory. You've got Monday night. Let's just break it down even further. On a Monday night, you would go and work Augusta. It was the only town running on Mondays. This is a good-sized town. It ran in Bell Auditorium. Nice building, as I remember it, and I wrestled there many times in 1970. It probably held 5,000, and it pretty much filled them up. Every Monday night, you would have 5,000 people in Bell Auditorium, and they were seeing some of the greatest wrestling that probably was ever ever there in Georgia, and Georgia's had some great wrestling in its history. On Tuesday, you had Savannah. Long trip. You want to drive to Augusta and drive back to Atlanta, and then you get up the next morning, and you got that afternoon trip. You've got to get out of there around 2 o'clock in the afternoon to get to Savannah in time to work, and you're not going to get home till about 4 in the morning. So guys started in the 70, early, then that same summer, that I'm talking about, the summer of 1970, guys started staying over. They would drive from Augusta to Savannah, which was only about an hour and a half, is about the same distance as getting back to Atlanta. But then they avoided that 4-hour drive the next day to get to Savannah. So they would go on, stay on the beach in Savannah, which is not a bad deal. They'd hang out on the beach in the summertime. They get some sun. They'd get their gym time in. They found a gym around there somewhere. They got their gym in. They got their sun there. They were well prepared for dealing with Georgia and the trips that were there. Wednesday night, you went to Columbus. That was Fred's town. You worked in a municipal auditorium, another nice building. It probably held, I'd say, 4,000. It might have been a little more than 4,000. It was a nice little building, though, and Fred was doing great business down there. Every town in Georgia was tremendous that summer because there was such a great crew there. There's no way they could have been in doing anything but great business. Thursday night, you had spot shows. Sometimes you worked for Fred, and you would go as far south as Albany, Americus, some of those towns down there in the southeastern corner of the state of Georgia. Or you would work in Rome, Georgia, for the Atlanta office, something that's up toward Tennessee. So you could go, but your travel is pretty decent trips either way, depending on where you are and which one of those cities that you're in. On Friday, everybody's in Atlanta. If you're going to work that on a Friday night and you're going to be in Atlanta, or you're not going to be working at all, because that was the hoss. It had the greatest cards. It had the greatest matches. It was the place to be on Fridays if you were a wrestling fan. Saturday, they had Griffin, Georgia. They had another building in Carrollton, Georgia. The one I think we'd already talked about, Dad built the building in Griffin called the Sportatorium, and it was probably 2,000, maybe 2,500 capacity. And it was strictly built for wrestling, but he had concerts. He had other events that were going on there in that same building. In Carrollton, they did the same thing. They redesigned the building interior, and they had made a wrestling venue there. So they would split the cards on Saturday night, because you had such a good group of wrestlers and they were so talented. You'd have two towns running on Saturdays. You'd have two towns running on Thursdays. And then everybody would be in the other major cities. It was a nice little setup, and it worked extremely well, obviously.
Before Gordon Solie, the commentator in Georgia, as you've talked about previously on the Studcast, was Ed Caprell. But there was a different setup altogether in Macon. You had a completely different television show with different hosts. And also, you mentioned Leon Ogle. There were different characters in that office that weren't necessarily in the Atlanta office. Choo Choo Lin. I don't know if you remember him. But
oh, yeah.
Talk a little bit about the office staff of Fred Ward's.
Well, you had obviously Fred ran his company. He's the head guy there, and he's got his two son-in-laws that are family members. Choo Choo's down there. And in the Atlanta office, you got Charlie Harbin. You've got Ronnie West, a young guy at that time, just getting started. You've got some of the old time referees there. And some of these names escape me because this is pretty far back, but, it's a really well run machine, considering that you have two different entities that own these companies, and they're working together with one group of talent, and they did it pretty smoothly. There wasn't very much animosity. There wasn't guys missing shots. As an example, Nashville ran They sit in the middle of 12 states, basically, and they ran a huge operation that Roy had built there back in the 30s and the 40s. And they had all these live TVs, and they had televisions that they had to send talent to. They had to send talent to Memphis early in the morning for a 90-minute live program. They sent talent to Knoxville for an afternoon live program. They sent talent to Chattanooga for a late afternoon live product. They sent talent to Birmingham for a 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock at night program live. So they had all these television stations that they were having to cover, and they seemed not to do it as smoothly as what the Georgia operation did. I think part of that is to the credit of Tom Renesto, who was doing the booking. There's a big, difficult situation in booking a business like this that has lots of televisions on the same day. If you've got two or three Saturday, and in the case of Tennessee, it's four or five major televisions and major markets on the same day, how do you make a great wrestling program for all those stations? It's really difficult to be able to do that. And Georgia did a great job of it. Their business was good all the time. Sometimes in Tennessee, they would suffer some because they could not manage to get all the right talent to the right televisions. When you also break it down too, Brian, you look at when you're booking, you're booking for one territory most of the time. You want to try to get the same guys into the same towns as often as you can, because you can start angles and you can build programs and you can get business up and doing great. But when you start yanking guys out that are big stars and you've got to send them to somebody else's town, then what happens is your business drops. Those towns that are doing well, Memphis, as an example, is a Fargo town. It's a Jackie Fargo. It's a Rough House Fargo. It's a Don Fargo situation. When you pull those Fargos out of there, one of them, two of them, or sometimes all three of them, and you send them to the other side of the state, to the eastern side of the state, Memphis is going to take a big drop on Monday night, because maybe they're not there on Monday. If they're going to work a TV in Knoxville, they need to work Knoxville on that following Friday. So all of that has to be pieced together by your booker, and he's just a key man to making sure all this talent is placed properly and placed on the card in a way that's going to draw money.
Couple questions for you, Ron. At this time in 1970, where are you living and who are you riding to shows with?
I'm living in 1970. I live in Griffin. In fact, I live right next to the Sportatorium there, which gives me a ring that I can go and work out in. And you don't really need to work out anymore once you start in a crew, because you're wrestling every night. You can't. Once you get to the point to where you're booked every night, you don't have a need to go into the ring and work on anything much, because you got plenty of time to work on it every night in an actual match. So that I lived in Griffin. Griffin is a little south of Atlanta, 30 miles south of Atlanta. It's where I went to basketball, played at basketball as a junior in high school. I'm very familiar with that area. I like that area. And that's where I stayed for the 3 or 4 months. I'm only going to be in Georgia for about 4 months. I start there as soon as I finish college. I come in there late May. And by September, I'm on my way to Tampa. I'm going to become a Florida guy for 4 years. I'm going to really cut my eye teeth in the state of Florida and with the Florida operation. But I'm so privileged to be a part of this Georgia operation because of the tremendous talent that is there and the tremendous business that they're doing. We'll talk a little bit, Brian, about money, how you got paid. You know, I mean, this is 1970. I'm green. I'm just getting started. I don't expect to make a lot of money. I'm just really happy to get to put on the tights and to go out there and do it every night. And the money is secondary almost. It's like, well, who cares? You know, I don't care what the payoff is. I just want to be somewhere and wrestling the next night. So some of these towns, if we take as an example, when Rob and I first started that summer, we would go to Augusta on a Monday and we would probably be first or second match. And there are times we probably didn't make $40. You know, it doesn't sound like much, but you're talking 1970. So 40's considerably more than what 40 sounds like in today's time.
Sure.
But it can give you an idea, you know, might make $40. You're going to go to Savannah. You might go and get a hotel room and buy a room, and you got to buy a couple of meals while you're there. You got to get back to Atlanta after that's over. Man, for your first, second match in Savannah, you might only make another $40. So you're two nights in, you've only made $80. You've got a hotel room you're paying for. You're paying for a couple of meals. You got to buy some gas. I mean, there are some expenses there. Wednesday, you're in Columbus. Your first or second match, you might only make 50. You might make 60 if you're lucky. But give the people an idea of what that's. Now, as the summer went on, we improved dramatically. We were finally able to end up, and I really want to talk about this next week, we were able to end up in a situation to where we had a little run with the Assassins way before we had the ability to be there probably. But we got that shot, and we started to get some main events. We started to get some semi-main events, in which that payoff got dramatically bigger because the wrestlers were paid upon a percentage of whatever the house drew. And if you were main event, you're going to make more than somebody that's obviously working first or second match. And that's the way it was pretty much across the entire country and around the world.
And who did you ride with at this time?
I made a lot of trips with Bill Dromo. Bill Dromo was an old veteran at that time and a good guy to travel with. One of those mentor type guys that liked to watch young guys. He wanted to help you. And that's one of the reasons I like to ride with him, is because it didn't just stop when you got to the building. You know, you had a good time and traveling with him. He was always joking and kidding and ribbing. And wrestlers did that. I think wrestlers are all great ribbers because they spent a lot of time together and they had to do something to make things happy, to make things good. Because riding in a car for somebody my height at 6'9" is not a good situation. And
right.
It's not the way you want to spend your day every day and your night every night, but you have to do other things to make it happen. Now, Dromo was really great about paying attention to your matches. It didn't have to ask him. He would, and when you would come back, he would say, "Ron, do you mind if I tell you what's some of the things you might improve upon?" And I was like, "Oh, absolutely, man! Hit me with it." And he was great at that. So we did a lot of trips with Dromo. Obviously, Rob and I did quite a few ourselves. Rob didn't live in Griffin. He lived in Locust Grove, which was another town south of Atlanta, too. But it was 30 or 40 miles from Griffin. And there was a little trouble for us to go back and forth. So occasionally I would make trips sometimes on my own. Didn't like to make the long ones on my own, but I would make shorter trips on my own. And it just, it was, like I said, the big thing for me and the big thing for Rob, I'm sure the Oates boys, was the fact that I'm booked, man. I'm working tonight. I'm working tomorrow night. I'm working the night after that. And that's what made us happy. That's what we wanted to do. I wasn't concerned about how much I was going to get paid. I was concerned about, am I going to have a job? Am I going to be able to stay in this crew and to keep going?
We talked about a lot of this crew last time on the show, the babyfaces and the heels. A couple of names I wanted to ask you about that we did not address, names that you would actually become quite familiar with when you got to Florida. One, of course, is Bobby Shane, who's in Atlanta at this time.
Yes. Great, great worker. gosh, I mean, one of the most talented guys that that probably ever came and put on a pair of tights. Young guy at that time, had a great look about him. I love to work with Bobby Shane because he was so good at his craft. He was one of the best heels I'd ever worked with. But he had something that he did that I think he had a way of slapping you in the back, and he would bend you forward. And I don't know whether he opened his hand or whether he cupped his hand or what it was, but I remember I just hated for him to hit me in the back. It's like, oh my gosh, Bobby, you know, and I'm sure, you know, I gave him probably a receipt or two as time went on. You know, I let him know that, hey, this, I can play that game too. But Bobby Shane was a phenomenal talent, and he died, gosh, in one of the most tragic ways that a person could die. And that was at a plane crash with Buddy Colt and Gary Hart, Austin Idol, who was Dennis McCord at the time, and Bobby Shane. And one of the most tragic and horrible deaths that I could even imagine, where he got his foot. The plane got compressed when it crashed into Tampa Bay, and they were just not too far from the airport. It was really bad weather. They weren't experienced. I don't think they were experienced at flying enough to be in the situation they were in. And when that plane got smashed, it crushed the front seat back onto Bobby's foot. And he was trapped in that plane, and that plane was sinking. And they couldn't get him out. And Austin and I have talked about this. Buddy Colt and I have had conversations about it. Never talked to Gary Hart about it, but that had to be one of the most traumatic and horrible experiences for three guys that could have possibly been. And they swam from that plane wreck, which is out in Tampa Bay, inshore to I guess it's Davis Island, is called. It's still a big area of Tampa there. And went and knocked on people's back door, man, all bloody and crippled and just horrible. So what a terrible, terrible night and a terrible experience. And wrestling lost one of its real stars that night. And that guy had so much talent. He was just roaring. His career, in my opinion, was far from peaking. He was destined to be the Bockwinkles of many territories, the guy that just, you know, that's what you look for when you're trying to put together a wrestling company that's going to draw money. You want to fill them with Bobby Shanes. If you can do that, you can really get it done. He came to Georgia, I believe, from Tennessee. I mean, not Tennessee, but Gulf Coast, down in that, working for the Fields. And he had gone down there. He was such a great worker that their business had been floundering and had been going a little south. It wasn't doing as good as it should have been. And they got their hands on Bobby Shane, and Bobby Shane lit him up there along the Gulf Coast, and then went to Georgia, and then goes from there, kind of like I do. He ends up in Florida about the same time I do, or actually about a year or so later than I got to Florida. But one of the great talents of all time.
And we'll talk about him more on a future Studcast and many future Studcasts when we get to Florida. But one more name, or a couple of names I want to ask you about from Atlanta at this time. Again, names that you'll run into in Florida are Buddy Colt. And he's there with Homer Odell. And of course, there's a match August 21st, 1970 at the Municipal Auditorium in Atlanta. It's a pretty big match. Ron, you with your brother Rob and your dad, Buddy Fuller, versus Buddy Colt, Homer Odell, and Carl von Stroheim. What do you remember about working with Buddy Colt and Homer Odell at this time?
Well, Buddy Colt's another great worker, a tremendous, tremendous worker. And he and Odell was his manager. And, so I don't know why Odell is in the ring for that. Homer Odell is a great character, and I have great Homer Odell stories. He's horrified of riots. Homer has a fear of riots that were just crazy. And when he worked for me at Southeastern, he's going to work for me at Southeastern. He's going to manage Toru Tanaka, a great talent in himself. And Homer is just going to, he's going to be crying like a woman most nights because there's not enough police there. Ron, their people are right on top of me. Ron, they're going to stab me. They're going to shoot me. I mean, it's like, come on, Homer. I said, this is part of the deal, man. This is just what the business is all about. And I remember one night seeing him. I'm wrestling with Tanaka, and he's managing Tanaka, and he wears a pith helmet, like a German pith helmet. And he has a big black leather jacket he wore all the time. And that night, we're wrestling in a town somewhere on the southeastern side of Kentucky. And it's just packed. Building is just packed. And the crowd is so into it. And Tanaka's a beast. He's capable of just annihilating, damaging a person beyond imagination, what he was capable of doing. And Homer's out there on the walking down the side of the apron, and Tanaka's got me in some type of hold, and I'm looking at Homer. And the guy comes running from up in the stands, comes running down the aisle, and dives onto Homer's back. Homer just starts screaming. He's just like, ah, oh, gosh. And he's trying to get him off, and he reaches back there, but he can't drag him over his head. He's just stuck on his back. I mean, the guy's clamped onto his back. So he starts down the side of the ring, and he gets close to the ring because he's wanting Tanaka to help him. He's thinking, you know, Tanaka's going to see this. Tanaka's going to do something. Well, I'm thinking, gosh, I hope Tanaka don't kill this guy, because I know Tanaka's going to do something to this guy to help Homer. And Tanaka gets out onto the apron, and he takes one of these karate kicks at the guy's head. And Homer, the guy's holding on so tight around Homer's neck that luckily Homer bends forward, and the guy's head moves from where Tanaka's kicking. He misses his head. He kicks right behind the guy's head because the guy's head goes down by Homer's head. And I'm like, oh, thank gosh. I remember that night, it was probably a semifinal. It wasn't the main event, and we could not do the main event because the riot got worse and worse and worse. It was just the beginning of it. But Homer didn't have the ability, certainly, of Stroheim or certainly not Buddy Cope. He had no right being in the ring, and I'm pretty sure that Homer is probably the guy that got beat, I imagine, in that tag, because Homer didn't have the ability to do much wrestling. But Homer was a real character.
How are you a heel if you're afraid of riots?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, what happens is some guys chill. I call it chilling. Some guys get the crowd to a point in which it scares them. And they go, oh, gosh, look, wow, this is going to get out of hand. And when you stop at that point, in my opinion, you're not really, you don't have guts. If you worked hard to get the crowd to hate you so much, then you should not have any dispensation to run or to back off from it. You know, the only time I ever got cut in a match was in Panama City, Florida in 1978, in a tag match with David Schultz, and I got cut in the ring. I reached out to grab Ricky Gibson by the hair. He's bleeding, and I'm dragging him back into the ring, and somebody cut me on the arm. I just drug him into the ring, and we just kept beating the heck out of him. I mean, the riot is beginning. You know, the people all came, and they grabbed him by the foot, and they drug him back out of the ring. And he's fighting to get back into the ring, and we're fighting to get him to get back into the ring. And it would have been a good thing if we'd have walked away from it, because it was the worst riot I was probably ever in. And we'll talk about that down the road, too. But that you can't be a great heel if you fear what heat. you can't fear heat and be a great heel. That's pretty well putting it succinctly.
I think so, Ron. And actually, you brought up Toru Tanaka, so this is a good time to go to a couple of listener questions that were sent in. And this first one is from Israel Napier in London, Kentucky. I remember you wrestling Toru Tanaka. How did you like working with him? And can you recall some of the matches?
I like working with Tanaka. Tanaka, gosh, he's a beast of a guy. To just kind of describe him, fans that don't know Tanaka, he looks like in the Goldfinger movie, there was a guy that called Odd Job. It was a little stout Japanese guy that had a hat that he would spin the hat and it would cut statues' heads off, cut rock statues' heads off. That was Tanaka. That his face reminded me of Tanaka, except Tanaka was 100 pounds bigger than that guy. Tanaka was probably 300 pounds, maybe 6 feet, and just a mass of muscle and strong like a bull. Just a really, really tough individual. And what really got more so than the matches I've had with Tanaka is I remember distinctly an interview that we did, Rob and I and Tanaka, and we were all partners. And it was a 2-minute interview. And I remember during the break, the commercial break, I looked at Tanaka and I said, how much time do you want here? And he said, I don't need much time. So, and he started putting these blocks up, these concrete blocks. They're 4-inch thick, solid thick, 4-inch blocks, maybe a foot long. And he stacked two of them, put two long ways standing up on end, and he put one across. And then he put two more standing up on end, and he put two on top of each other. There's 8 inches of thick concrete. And then he puts another one there that's got 3 4-inch blocks. It's 12 inches of solid concrete. And I'm like, I'm watching. Rob and I were watching during the commercial break, and like we're looking at each other like, what in the heck is he going to do here? And So, boom, I don't even get a chance to ask him. You know, I'm thinking that, and the interview starts. So I start, and then Rob does his part. And we're watching the clock go down, and it's down to around 15 seconds. And I go, you know, he hasn't spoken. He's done nothing whatsoever. He's not warmed up either, which really, that's the part that really got me. He's just cold. He's just standing there cold. He hasn't warmed up. He's not got his blood rushing in his body or anything. And I say, what do you got to say, Tanaka? And he goes, I not got something. I don't say nothing. I show you what I want, what I feel. And he just takes one hand and he drops through that 4-inch block. Then he drops down. There's the two of them there. Now it's 8 inches solid. He drops down on his knees and brings his elbow down on top of them. I mean, he don't just break the blocks. He crushes them. I mean, the blocks are flying everywhere. The studio and the people in the studio they're flying across and underneath the ring and into people's seats. And then he takes and drops on his knees for the third one and busts those 12 inches with his forehead. I was like, oh my gosh, within 10 seconds, he totally demolished all those blocks right there in front of us. I was like, I think Rob and I probably stand there with our mouths open when the interview went off. Like, what in the heck was that? It was just unbelievable. So he was a great guy, a super guy, and well-liked. People really loved Tanaka in Knoxville. He got over. He came in as a heel, and he worked with Fuji, the WWE Fuji from way back, the WWF, I'd say, back in seniors, McMahon seniors day.
Yeah, and he ended up settling in East Tennessee.
He sure did. He never left. Fuji stayed. Tanaka stayed for a long time, and he stayed even after he left. He would come back. He kind of made Knoxville his home. That happened to a lot of wrestlers that came there for me for Southeastern Wrestling in the 70s, toward the mid-70s, on into the late 70s, that never left that town. Stomper, Mongolian Stomper, another one.
Yeah.
Came there, never left. Went to work for the police department. It was a beautiful part of the country, a great place to live. And guys made it their homes. They got so involved with it. They just loved it. Really just loved being there. Tanaka was one of those guys. And he was a pleasure to work with. Never complained about anything. You never had any problem with anything you asked him to do. He would do it. He was just a real, real pleasure to work with. And one of the great guys in the sport.
You said Tanaka reminded you of Odd Job from the James Bond film. Odd Job was actually played by Tosh Togo, another wrestler. Were you ever actually around Tosh Togo?
No. No, I wasn't.
Yeah, I didn't think so, because he didn't really wrestle. He was more of a West Coast wrestler, I guess, than an East Coast wrestler.
Yeah, and I think that's probably why he got in the movies out there, you know. Personally, I think if they had found Tanaka, he would have made a lot more impact than Tosh Togo. I mean, Tanaka was so much bigger than Togo.
Much more intimidating.
Yeah, a lot more intimidating. Darn right.
Well, Ron, I have one more question this week that was sent in from one of our listeners. It is from Robbie Stewart in Panama City, Florida. Hopefully this is not the man who cut you in Panama City.
Yeah, I hope not.
Let's hope not. But here's his question, Ron. Who was your best friend in the wrestling community, not counting your family?
Oh, that's a good question. There are certain guys that I really, really, really loved being around that were great in it. One when I came to Florida, he'd probably been wrestling for 10 years. He was pretty darn good. And he took a liking to me, and we got to be best friends. And we'd go out to the beach on Sundays, and we'd go to visit other guys. He became really close, and that was Les Thatcher. Les Thatcher, then, once I get into Southeastern and open up, I'm looking for a commentator, and Les and I started a relationship again, which turns out to be a super deal for me, and it's a great deal for Les, too. He got to run a television program. He became my commentator, and I kind of turned the reins over to him and let him handle the TV production. He did a great job of it, and we remain friends to this day. I talk to him every once in a while. I just really have a lot of respect and admiration for Les, and I really like him a lot. Another one is Bob Armstrong. Bob Armstrong is like, you know, we've had feuds, and we've been back and forth in the ring. Maybe I've wrestled Bob Armstrong more times than any person that I've wrestled in my career. But Bob is a genuinely just a phenomenal person. He's a Hall of Famer, and he deserves it. He's a fabulous guy in the ring, and he is a fabulous guy out of the ring. He has 4 sons, 3 now. We've lost Brad, which is a shame, but he raised 4 absolutely phenomenal young men that just really went on to have great careers. One of them, Brian, followed in his dad's footsteps and ended up being, I guess, one of the big Marines that handles the events in Washington itself. Just a Marine, a great American, and just a fabulous person. We're still friends. Talked to him 2 days ago. I talked to him quite regularly. And I talked to him 2 days ago, and he says, "Ron, I'm really happy. I have a show booked next week." I said, "How old are you?" He said, "I'm 78. and somebody sent, I saw something on social media the other day of his dance. He did his little dance still at 78 years old. Somebody recorded the dance. He did the Bad to the Bone dance. And he said it was great. Great to see Bob still out there and still being able to do it. He's just an unreal person.
When was the first time you saw him dance?
When he did Bad to the Bone.
Okay. This is like 15 years into your friendship with him. So what did you think the first time you see him out there boogieing?
Oh, well, you know, Bob was a super talented person. I mean, he could dance. I had seen him dance before. I knew he could dance. But when he got that bad to the bone, you know, that's part of wrestling's changes too, Brian. You know, we all came in. You didn't have any music. You had any intro music. You lucky if you had a wrestling jacket or some kind of robe to wear at the ring. You know, a lot of guys like my dad would take a towel and go to the ring. That's all there was to it. There was no fanfare. There was no music, all of that. Well, once they started that music, man, and Bob discovered that bad to the bone, I'm telling you, he made it work. And he really worked that song. He was great at it. When I get into hockey, after wrestling is over, my first team in Nashville, I'm going to go there and I'm going to start changing hockey and I'm going to darken my building and I'm going to turn on the spotlights and I'm be darned if it ain't going to be bad to the bone, man. I love that song. It just set the tone for the evening, for the hockey game and for the hockey fans. And it's a great song. And to see Bob do it has just always been a thrill. He does it great. I got two others I can think of real quickly here. One of them is Ken Lucas. Ken Lucas was a super talent around the business. One of the most liked wrestlers by the other wrestlers that I've ever been around. I never knew him very much, and he came to work for me at Southeastern in 1980, probably 81. And I got to be great friends with Ken Lucas. Ken Lucas was a super talented guy who had so many interests in so many different directions. He was into music. He was into movies. He really had a handle on what was happening out there. You could make trips with him and you'd get back. You'd have albums that you'd go buy. I mean, you'd go start. He'd have you convinced that this guy's going to be big and that guy's going to be big. Ken was great. He was great. And I really, really admired him. He had a great amount of respect and he earned every bit of it. And one more I can think of off the top of my head is Ron Bass. Ron Bass, big son of a gun, made a lot of money. Went all over and worked on top just about every place he ever went, I guess. Ron Bass and I had never spent any time with him till he came and wrestled for me. Same time frame as Lucas. He's there in 1981 and the crew I had in 81 in Pensacola. And just really a wonderful guy. I got to be really, really tight with Ron. And he died this past year. He passed this past year. And I was really sad to hear it. Great guy. And he lived in the Tampa area, down in the area where I've lived a bunch.
One more question about Bob Armstrong, just because obviously he's here in 1970 as you're starting out in Atlanta. He would be in Florida at different times when you're in Florida. He would eventually come work for you in Southeastern. He would eventually be a partner with you. When exactly did your friendship really develop?
Probably in the Knoxville days, 1975, when he first came to wrestle for me. I had been around him, like you said, even in 1970. In this time frame we're talking about in this program, the summer of 1970, he's in there. He's doing some stuff in there. But we never got close until we started making trips. And we started making trips together at Southeastern in Knoxville. I had a great group of – I had some – fabulous talent there back in those days. And Bob just really fit in perfectly. And he fell in love with it. That's a strange place. That Knoxville had a way of taking guys and changing their lives where they just went, wow, this is the place of one of the most beautiful places in America. And it truly is up there in the Smoky Mountains. It's got these beautiful lakes. It's just a beautiful place to live. And Bob fell in love with it and basically lots of times would say, Ron, I don't never want to leave. I don't ever want to go anywhere else, you know? And I said, well, you know, it's pretty hard to keep somebody forever, Bob, but we managed to do it, and we managed to have a run from 78 to just about 88, a 10-year run with Southeastern and Pensacola and with Continental after that, in which our families feuded for 10 years, and we drew nothing but huge crowds. We probably created more wrestling fans in that 10 years' time in that part of the country than they had ever had. We just really had some phenomenal years.
Well, Ron, we had such a good time this week. We didn't even get an opportunity to speak about half of the things we planned on speaking about. So next week on the show, we will pick up right from where the story left off. We will talk about various items, including the deaths that happened in the ring in Savannah, Georgia. More about that next week. But as we begin to wrap things up, I want to remind you, if you enjoy the Studcast that comes at you each and every week for free, then consider becoming a patron of the show, which you can do at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. The rest of the Ron Wright story will debut for patrons on Sunday, February 25th. And of course, the 2-hour Andre the Giant Super Studcast and the Ron Wright Super Studcast are really taking off. We're getting great feedback about them. Once again, available at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast for only $2.99. That includes the 1-hour rest of the story. So once again, tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. That's 3 hours of wrestling history told by one of America's best storytellers, the Stud himself. Thanks to all of our listeners, our growing number of patrons that support our effort to continue to bring you 7 hours of wrestling podcasts each month. On social media, you can follow Ron on Twitter and Instagram at Ron Fuller Welch. You can follow me on Twitter at Great Brian Last, and you can follow the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network on Twitter at Super Podcast. Like the Tennessee Stud on Facebook at Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud. And of course, visit his website at tnstud.com. Everything is there, including regular weekly studcasts and both type of super studcasts. You can hear me each and every week on the 605 Super Podcast at 605pod.com, available on iTunes, Stitcher, Podcast Addict, and everywhere else. And if you enjoy the Studcast and you listen on iTunes, please go to iTunes and leave us a positive review and a 5-star rating. It really does help the show out. Ron Fuller's Studcast is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. Until next week, for the Tennessee Stud, I'm the Great Brian Last. The story continues next time.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So fool Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud.
1, 2, 3.
This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains.